Hey, we're getting very good at this. We're getting interactive. Fabulous. This is a tremendous development. Yeah, it's major altogether, isn't it? I have just come back from skiing holiday. I've been away for 3 or 4 days skiing. With the lads. It was the lads weekend. And I must say, it was kind of like, it was a step back into something that I've forgotten all about. All the language and all the stuff. You know, words that had got omitted from my vocabulary for a long period of time, like wuss. Are you going to come this way or are you going to be a wuss? You know, or like, well, which way are you going? Well, we're going down this way. Well, this is the boys' way down. But if you, the girls can go over there. You want to be a boy, you want to be a girl, you know. And all this kind of stuff. And, you know, there's sort of 14 of these guys and they arrive and it's like, I don't know, we get in like 11 o'clock in the evening. Into the ski resort, and we'll go out and have a quick beer. That's what they say, and I say, oh, I'm going to bed. See you later. They get back at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then they get up and ski the next day. I mean, and you suddenly realise actually, it's actually very good to be introduced to this because you this is what life is like, isn't it? This is what is involved in living in the world. This is where we get reminded, isn't it, that it is a battle. Do we agree? So that's some of what I want to talk about. Okay, so the title of my talk today is Seizing Your Divine Initiative. Now, how many of you are home group leaders who are here on the weekend? Not too many. Few. Okay, well, I'm sorry for you guys. You've heard this once before. You're gone. Okay. But it's probably a slightly different version. Seizing Your Divine Initiative, or Daring to Live a Life of Adventure. And the subtitle is The Jonathan Factor, which seems hugely appropriate, as we've got a Jonathan arriving, doesn't it? Very good. I thought that was good. But first of all, I wanted to sort of just paint a little background. I think sometimes, I don't know what it feels like to you, but sometimes I think it can feel, when you're a Christian in Ireland, it feels a bit like you're paddling upstream, or skiing uphill, or climbing uphill with skis on in 6 foot snow. When you kind of want to share, you know, you're burning with something to share about what God has been doing in your life, and it's like hitting a brick wall. Does it sometimes feel like that to you?
Yeah.
Cool. So I'm not just on my own. Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about this lady I read about called Helen Suzman. Don't know if you've heard of Helen Suzman. Oh, we have. Oh, well, you have, because you were on the weekend. That's cheating. But a few. Actually, yes, I see my South African friends nodding. Very good. She was a white, upper-middle-class liberal lady, born into the era in South Africa when apartheid ruled the game. Apartheid was the way. And she fought against apartheid. She was arguing with entrenched opinion. Now, clearly, she had the cause on her side. And she went through many of the different prime ministers that were prime ministers of South Africa at the time, like Forward and Forster and Botha, those men of great farsight, and embracing the cause of the underprivileged. Sorry, sarcasm. I'm not supposed to do sarcasm, am I? Forster, what progress did she see during that period? If you think through that period of South Africa's history, what progress do you recall? When Forster was the South African Prime Minister between 1966 to 1978, he made one or two small concessions, but nothing really. Apartheid did not seem to be about to change. In fact, there was a poll in the Johannesburg Sunday Times, there was a survey done. What do you think about how this guy is doing in terms of running South Africa? 70% of the white population, which was the population that was voting and the one that they polled, thought that Forster was doing a good job. 0.3% of South Africa's white population thought he was not doing a good job. Helen Suzman's response was, I prefer to be counted with the minority. Isn't that a wonderful response? Now, of course, we can see now, with the benefit of hindsight, not only the justice and the rightness of the cause for which he was fighting, but also the inevitable outcome. The fact that inevitably this could not stand. And it's very easy, isn't it, to say, oh, well done, Helen, great job. Weren't you the one standing up there and taking all the flak? But we see it from the advantage of the outcome. She had to fight the battle from within the middle of it. Nelson Mandela paid tribute to her as a key part of the victory over apartheid. Here's a poem that was written in the 1800s, which I think sums up this sense. Say not the struggle nought availeth. Say not the struggle nought availeth. The labour and the wounds are vain. The enemy faints not nor faileth. And as things have been, they remain. If hopes were dupes, fears may be liars. It may be in yon smoke concealed, your comrades chase even now the flyers, and but for you possess the field. For while the tired waves, vainly breaking, seem here no painful inch to gain, far back through creeks and inlets making, come silent, flooding in the main. And not by eastern windows only, when daylight comes in the light, in front the sun climbs slow, how slowly, but westward, look, the land is bright. Isn't that good? Don't we feel like tired waves sometimes? So I think there's that sense of, you know, we do, somewhere in our hearts and our spirits, we know the outcome of the battle, and yet we find it hard to see. Now I think the other aspect of this is this sense of running out of time. I think we've seen various sort of apocalyptic events, and perhaps the one, you know, the Twin Towers or the tsunami. You know, these are events that really somehow, I don't know if they speak to you in this way, but they speak to me in a kind of apocalyptic way. Now, as you know, I get spoken to in terms of pop songs, so there are pop songs that do it for me as well. Do you remember Prince, around about 2000, about the turn of millennium? You know, he did a thing about the turn of the millennium. 2000, party over. Oops, out of time. Do you remember that? So tonight I'm going to party like it's 1999. You don't. He probably sang it a bit better, didn't he? So all of these various things are sort of pointing towards that sort of sense of running out of time. In Revelation 1:3 it says, how blessed the reader, how blessed the hearers and keepers of these oracle words. All the words written in this book, time is just about up. And again in the message, continuing in that verse. I, John, am writing this to the seven churches in Asia province. All the best to you from the God who is, the God who was, and the God about to arrive. That struck me. I hadn't heard it like that before. Had you? Matthew 24:14. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Now that, to the apostles and the disciples, must have seemed, I mean, how would that ever have happened? To us, it's very visible, isn't it? We're kind of picking out who hasn't heard now. It from end to end. And then the end will come. That was Jesus speaking. 2 Peter 3:9. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise. Isn't that the sense of so much of the world today? Where is this God of yours, who you say is coming back? Where is he? It's gone on like this forever and a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. He is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish. Isn't that the heart that Rob was articulating at the beginning of the service? He doesn't want anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. And what I thought was wonderful, what I love about the way the Lord does services, is he brings it all together, doesn't he? Do you remember the passage that Rob wrote out at the beginning from Hebrews? In chapter 10, he who is coming will come and will not delay. I thought, don't you think that? I always think it's just amazing how God sort of brings all these things together. And then when you looked at the worship songs that we were singing, perfect love, that casting out all fear and enabling us to do what I'm coming on to. So the heart of God is salvation for the lost, and this sense of urgency galvanizes me to redouble my efforts. I think we can see Helen's victory. We know the outcome. But we must not be daunted by the Goliaths that confront us. And what are the Goliaths that are confronting us? The Goliaths of the mindset. It's a subtle combination, isn't it? Of disaffection, disappointment with the church. I saw Irish Times poll recently on Monday or Tuesday when I was flying out. 87% of people in Ireland believe in God. I don't know what that means to them or what impact it has in their lives. But that's an amazing statistic, isn't it? But it ain't being reflected, is it? I mean, if I go and talk to this 87% and say, how do you feel about Jesus? Should we have a good conversation about Jesus? Are you stirred about Jesus? They'd be going, you're right. Try a drink. Right? Or at least that's my experience. I don't know, maybe you've got... Yeah? So, we've got on the one hand this disaffection and disappointment with the church. And consequently, an embrace of secularism, consumerism, and hedonism. Aren't these the Goliaths that confront us? Aren't those the Goliaths that confront you when you're going out to try and share? Yes? So now is the time to redouble our efforts. The net of all of this is that we need to move forwards, and that is the context within which I would like us to look at our passage. And the passage is in 1 Samuel 14, chapter 14, verses 1 to 23, and I think you might find it on page 283. Yeah, do make sure people have got Bibles, that'd be brilliant, because I think that would help. So, this is something I shared at the home group, and I really feel it is something for us as a church as a whole, and I wanted to share it with this congregation and with the evening congregation. So let's start at the beginning of Samuel 14. Now, a detachment of Philistines had gone out to the pass at Michmash. One day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to the young man bearing his armor, "Come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men, among whom was Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod. He was the son of Ichabod's brother, Ahitub, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh. No one was aware that Jonathan had left. On each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozes and the other Seneh. One cliff stood to the north towards Michmash and the other to the south towards Geba. That's a lot of tricky names. Jonathan said to his young armor-bearer, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised fellows. Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." "Do all that you have in mind," his armor-bearer said. "Go ahead, I'm with you, heart and soul." Jonathan said, "Come then, we will cross over towards the men and let them see us. If they say to us, 'Wait there until we come to you,' we'll stay where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands." So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. "Look," said the Philistine, "the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they're hiding in." The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, "Come up to us and we'll teach you a lesson." So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Climb up after me, the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet with his armor-bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan and his armor-bearer followed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor-bearer killed some 20 men in an area of about half an acre. Then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field and those in the outposts and raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. Saul's lookouts at Gibeah and Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. So Saul piled in. No, he didn't. Then Saul said to the men who were with him, "Muster the forces and see who has left us." When they did, it was Jonathan and his armor-bearer who were not there. Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the Ark of God." At that time, it was with the Israelites. While Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all his men assembled and went to the battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them to their camp went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. When all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So the Lord rescued Israel that day, and the battle moved on beyond Beth-Aven. Okay, so quite a long passage, but I think some important points to pull out of it. First of all, when a battle was taking place in the ancient Near East, one concept that has to be understood in the context of this passage is that battles between nations were considered battles between the gods that ruled those particular nations. So in this case, this conflict between the Philistines and Israel was seen between as a battle between the God of Israel. Who is God? Is the God of Israel God, or is the God of the Philistines? Second thing, the forces arrayed against the Philistines here are enormous. If you look at 1 Samuel 13 verse 5, the Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. So it's a massive outpouring of these Philistine forces against them. The result, the Israelites went and hid in the rocks. Some went over to the enemy. Not great, huh? And on top of that, the Philistines have got the position on top of the cliff. I mean, from a military perspective, this is pants. Would you agree? Yes? But, on top of that, also, they've got no weapons. In 1 Samuel 13, 19, you'll see, not a blacksmith to be found in the whole land of Israel, because the Philistines had said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So the Philistines weren't stupid either. The Hebrews didn't have any method of making swords and spears. They had all the blacksmiths. The Hebrews had given them to sharpen their farm implements, and the boys, quite rightly, hadn't given them back to them. So on top of that, they find themselves in the battle with two swords apiece, one with Saul and one with Jonathan. That's not great either. Yet, in the midst of all of this, in 1 Samuel chapter 7, God has clearly told the Philistines, Israel, has clearly told Israel to go. He says, if you will put away all these things that you've been doing, put away this worship of Baal and Ashtoreth, if you do that, I will make you victorious over the Philistines. And if you read that in 1 Samuel 7, you'll see that promise. Now, perhaps you're starting to see some of the parallels. I think there are two key parallels to our situation. Firstly, the forces that they're facing are overwhelming. Our battle, though, unlike theirs, which was a battle against soldiers, our battle is not against flesh and blood. As it says in Ephesians chapter 6, our battle is against principalities and powers. And I thought Jack did a wonderful job last Sunday of talking about those, what those principalities and powers were, didn't he? Everybody's forgotten. No, I'm seeing nods. The consumerism, the hedonism. These are the principalities and powers that we are fighting against. So we're not fighting flesh and blood. But the forces do seem overwhelming. They do hem us in. Second thing that I think is a key parallel, we have been told to go. I think if you look at Samuel 7, it's not quite as clear. But for us, it is blindingly clear. You cannot read any single gospel. You cannot read the New Testament and not be clear that God has told us to go. It's there very clearly at the end of Matthew. It's there very clearly at the end of Mark. And if you look... Oh, welcome. That's always a good sign when we're being disturbed, isn't it? We must be doing something right. And then if you look at Luke's gospel, which is Luke and Acts... Don't be distracted. Keep going. Keep with me. Stay with me. Okay? Let them go and sort that out. Okay? Luke and Acts, right at the beginning, Jesus says to them, right at the beginning of Acts, because that's the same man writing the two things, you'll be my witnesses in Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. Clear instruction to go. Fourth, John's gospel, he says, the whole reason I've written this is so that you'll believe. So you cannot read the New Testament and not be clear that we're being told to go. And what's the promise? That if we go, I am with you. I am with you. And I think that's one of the key messages of the Lord today for you. I am with you. Exactly where you are right now at the moment. Whatever's going in your life, I'm with you. So, do you think those two parallels are clear? Good. Sorry. I'm asking you a lot of check questions. Okay. There are five key things I want to go through as we look at it. So, firstly, seize your divine initiative. This is my first point. What is Jonathan saying here? Jonathan is basically saying, tell you what, let's go up, pick a fight with them, who knows, God might get involved. Is that the way you do stuff? And just to make it a bit more complicated, let's make the determinant of whether God is with me or not what comes out of the mouth of the enemy after I've committed myself. I mean, he's very un-PC, isn't he? I mean, I don't see the flat on the floor, the weeping and wailing, and Lord, what's your will and where am I going? Do you? He just seizes the initiative. He's not waiting for a silver revival bullet. Lord, send your silver revival bullet so that all the Philistines come down and go, oh, Lord, it's Israel. He just gets on with it and goes for it. So where's Saul, who is the king, who is the leader? Saul is sitting under a pomegranate, under the shade of a pomegranate tree. It's a good place, isn't it? Ah, it's nice. You see, poor Saul actually has just been through an experience where he's been so desperate to seek the Lord that he actually became disobedient. He was told to wait until Samuel came. And he didn't, because he was so desperate to hear from the Lord. So he's just been disobedient. So he's trying to work his way through that. So now he doesn't know what to do. So actually now, when he should have waited, he acted. And now he should go. They're trying all sides, aren't they? They'll break in. Maybe we should just have me. No, that would be completely disruptive, wouldn't it? So Saul should have waited, but instead he acted. Now he should be going, and instead he's waiting. So poor old Saul, he's getting it all back to front. Does that happen to us? Can we get so good at waiting and not going that we're waiting for God and the whole time he's waiting for us? Could that be the case? See, like Joshua and Caleb, who were not overwhelmed by the forces against them, Jonathan was not overwhelmed by the forces that stood against him. Who is God in Ireland today? That's the battle, isn't it? Is Jesus God? Is Jesus Lord? Or is consumerism, hedonism, and secularism the right places to find satisfaction? That's the question. But what an adventure! Huh? As he takes that step, as he climbs up the cliff, what an adventure! I mean, imagine defeating an army like that single-handedly. No? I think that would be awesome. Okay, that would be great. So seize the opportunity. My second point is the battle is God's. Jonathan's contribution, when you look at the scale of things, is actually tiny. He kills 20 people. How many thousands of people were out there? How many thousands confronted him? There were 20. You might feel your contribution is tiny. But God honors the initiative. And then he joins in. And that's where the fun starts. And panic struck at the whole army. Those in the camp and field and those in the outposts and raiding parties.
In fact, it was so exciting. The microphone fell off.
And it was panic sent by God. And Saul's lookout see the army melting away. Mother Teresa was often asked, you know, well, do you really feel that you're really making much of an impact here? She said, no, it's a drop in the ocean. But the ocean would notice if the drop was missing. Isn't that beautiful? But you see, as God honors the initiative that he's taken and he joins in, that's when it happens. Now, the solution to the seemingly impossible problem, where were they going to get all the swords from to fight a battle like that, suddenly becomes apparent. Of course, there are plenty of swords. Lack of swords, not a problem at all. The Philistines have got thousands of them. So they end up using the swords against one another. That was God's plan all along. So the battle belongs to the Lord. And I've already mentioned it's not flesh and blood, but it's every place where you place your foot, I will give you. That's what it says. And I see in this correlation between the Jonathan story and the Joshua story. Every place where I ask you to set your foot, I will give you. God works in this way, doesn't he? He wants us to do the foot placing. So often we're waiting for him to just convert the land as a whole, but he's actually asking us to place the foot one at a time. My third point, so the battle is God's. My third point is this. The outcomes are uncertain. Perhaps he will act. If you were the armor bearer, and Jonathan said to you, you know, let's go up, let's attack these guys, let's see what happens. What would you have replied? I think my response might have been, well, Jonathan, do you want to get back to me when you're certain whether God's going to be involved in this or not? Or maybe, he's a great armor bearer, that one over there. I'm sure he'd be brilliantly with you. But the armor bearer, he doesn't promise us that, though. God doesn't promise us that the outcome is going to be the way we want it to be, does it? He doesn't promise us certainty of outcome, yet all the time we're looking for ourselves and our place to be secure and safe and just the way we want it. But he's not. He does promise us that we can be sure of relationship with him. He doesn't promise how the journey is going to play out. In fact, if Paul and Jesus are anything to go by, close walk with Jesus seems to involve fellowship in his sufferings. So I think actually the more that we get into the battle, the more we should expect to be suffering. That's what it seems to me to be part of what he's involved in. In fact, what is interesting, I think, with the outcome of this is it's Saul's overburdening leadership that ends up preventing it from being decisive. He puts an unnecessary spiritual burden on the soldiers, which prevents them from being physically effective, because he's told everybody to fast during the course of the battle. And Jonathan actually picks honey up and eats it and is given vigor for the battle. So there's another key leadership lesson there. Don't put those you're entrusted with under unnecessary burdens. My fourth point is this. Leadership is behavior, not position. Too much we've adopted the world's view of leadership that it has to do with position, status, hierarchy, and such authority. It's not. Jonathan has no leadership position. He has no status. But Jonathan shows leadership. Jonathan acts. God joins in. Everybody follows. But look at how he does it. There's no criticism of Saul. Too often when things aren't going the way we want them to do, we criticize those who are in our leadership or those in positions of authority or hierarchy. There's no criticism of Saul. There's no whipping up of Saul's soldiers against him and saying, look, he should be moving. God's told him to move. There's no attempt to take over his position. Jonathan was a doer, not a critic. Getting things done, not analyzing things. And yet our consumer world would have us become product analysts. And we sideline then, don't we? We become very good at observational comment rather than getting involved and getting things to move forward. Because what God is calling us to is the priesthood of all believers. Yeah? He's calling all of us to be involved in leadership in some way, shape, or form. To be the priest to those who don't know him. And, you know, even when the army is melting away, Saul is still trying to seek God. I mean, if you look in verse 16, you know, when he sees the army melting away, Saul says to Ahijah, bring the Ark of God, which was the way in which they would seek the Lord. So even when it's blindingly flipping obvious, Saul's still going, Lord, what are you saying here? Should we go? Should we stay? Contrast Paul. If you look in Acts chapter 16, you'll see that through verses 6 and 10, there's two or three places. Saul's trying to go into Asia, but he's prevented from going into Asia. Then he tries to go into, I think it is, Bithynia. And the Spirit of God prevents Paul from going into Bithynia. And then that night, Paul has a dream, and a man from Macedonia is calling him. Isn't that a bit backy-fronty to the way we would do it? We'd go, oh, which way? Paul's out there. Do you see, he's got that same Jonathan thing, hasn't he? Do you see what I'm saying there? So my fifth point is this. Let's be together, heart and soul. If you look at verse 7, it says, the armor bearer says, do all that you have in mind, his armor bearer said. Go ahead, I'm with you, heart and soul. Where have I got my scriptures here? In Joshua 1, chapter 3, in 6 to 7, in the message, it says, strength, courage. You are going to lead this people to inherit the land that I promised to give their ancestors. Give it everything you have, heart and soul. This is the call, I feel, is the call to courage. If we are in this together, heart and soul, if we're in what we are doing together as a church, heart and soul, the church will become an unstoppable force. So I was, in fact, this guy Owen and I are kind of fond of, he defines what this notion of an unstoppable force is. And he was down at the zoo with his children, and they were looking at various different animals. And you know how animals have different descriptions when they're joined together, like cows when they're joined together are a herd, very good. And crows when they're joined together are, or lions when they're joined together are a, and crows when they're joined together are a, very good. Wow, these guys are brilliant. And, oh yeah, well, you've got all the hungry boys. Yeah, hungry boys have to be quiet. Okay, and then buzzards when they're joined together are? Very nearly. A committee. Doesn't that explain a lot? Now, rhinos weigh 1.5 tons, can reach a speed of 30 miles an hour and can see 30 yards in front of them. You see, what's at 31 yards doesn't matter. It just better get out of the way. Do you know what a collection of rhinos is called? A crash. Isn't that brilliant? That's what an unstoppable force is. So what does all of this above stuff that I've been taking you through mean? For us, what does this move dimension? Because that is what comes through. Jonathan takes the step. What does that mean for us? One, change. Who likes change? Great. Because if we are being transformed into the likeness of Jesus Christ, which is his wish for us, that is going to involve change. So the only constant we should be expecting is hallelujah. I believe this is going to be a year of key transition for us. You might say, well done, Andrew, that's flipping obvious. Okay, fair dues. Because clearly, with Jonathan coming, that's going to be significant. I think it's going to be mean change for us at a personal level. I think it's going to be change for us at a church level. I think it's going to mean change in the way that we do things, and I think there is going to be change in the climate as well. Second thing, we need to be outward looking. If, like me then, despite being no evangelist, but you're feeling a greater burden for the lost and looking to play my part and asking, how can I help the evangelists? Not, I don't want anybody feeling a burden to do something that they're not called to do. But a call to move is to look for where I can climb the cliff and where I can make my contribution. Where is the piece that you can make your 20-man contribution within the context of where you are with what you've got? Third thing, responsibility and ownership. For me, the carol service was just a wonderful joy in many different ways. But one of the key ways it was a joy was the way in which a vast team of people from all parts of the church came together and worked effectively together using such a wide range of different giftings, and how it felt like a single group of people working together. That, I think, is the vision of a church that is working unstoppably. What I want to see is a spreading out of this culture. So the advancement of the church is for all. Inviting people to the church is for all. Integration of visitors who come to the church into places where they can be known and make friends is for all. Anything, in fact, that helps the Lord's clear request for us to make disciples. So the net of all of this, what's the net of all of this? Quote Theodore Roosevelt, do what you can with what you have where you are. That, I think, is the Lord's call to us today. And when we were praying about this morning, and Rob's already mentioned that, I think there were two key things, and I hope that in some way these have come out of it. Firstly, that the Lord loves us. And secondly, that the Lord is with us. Because those are the things that are critical for us to understand in the midst of it. When I was praying yesterday and praying about speaking to us today, I felt there were two ways in which there were so many of us that wanted to be in that place that would ascend that cliff, but felt unable to. And I felt there were two things particularly that had happened. One was that people had maybe either tried or made a step or gone a step in that direction and somehow had got burnt, it hadn't worked, and therefore they had retreated into church stuff that they were comfortable with. Home group on Wednesday, coming to church on Sunday, and the odd conference. And that was the place of safety. And then the second group I felt was the whole area of we sin. We're sinners. And I know I can often feel that way, that I think, well, Lord, how could you use me? And then it becomes guilt and shame that that hold us back. And there were two things that the Lord reminded me of when I was praying about this. And the first was the picture in Zechariah in chapter 3, and it is the picture of Joshua, and Joshua comes before the Lord and he's wearing these filthy rags. And that felt really symbolic. Often we feel we're in those filthy rags and we can't do this very thing that we know the Lord wants us to do. But what happens in that situation? What happens is that the robes are taken off and a clean, fresh set is put with on Joshua so that he can be the high priest. See, that's the grace and the mercy. We have to trust Jesus that what he says is true. That we are sinners and that we are going to sin again and again. But it's his grace and mercy that clothes us with fresh new clothes so that we can do this climbing that he's calling us to climb. And the second passage was this. My dear children, I write this to you so that you will not sin. But if anybody does sin, we have one who speaks to the Father in our defense, Jesus Christ, the righteous one. He knows that we do sin, but his desire is for us to be walking with him. And he is here now. And he clearly wants us to go. Because his heart, as Rob spoke right from the beginning, is breaking for those who don't know him. Can any of you relate to either of those two pictures? Would you put your hands up if you can? Okay. Great. In that case, could you please stand up and come to the front? And let's all of us stand so that we can make this kind of work okay. So if you had your hand up, perhaps if you felt that, yes, just come. And let's just move in, and there's plenty of room here. Do feel free, do come. I've often found, you know, sometimes you can be feeling off, if I'm not sure, is it me, did I get it right, blah, blah, blah. I think it's just pressing into what God is wanting to do. Is always the best thing. This is an opportunity Jesus Christ is here and is here amongst us and wants to bless his children. So perhaps you just hold your hands out, and perhaps those of you who are around the back, perhaps you would just stretch your hands out as I pray for them, so that you can be joining in my prayer, and that we as a church are seeking to bless our brothers and sisters and to equip them for all that God is going to do. Father, I want to pray for those who maybe have got caught in the holy huddles. And Father, we've been afraid. Father, I thank you for that word, that song that Owen was singing. Perfect love casts out all fear. And Father, I want to pray this morning for all of those who have come forward for that particular reason. Father, I want to pray that you would pour out your perfect love upon each and every person who came forward for that, Lord. I pray, Lord, that you would change something, that you would make something different this morning, that there would be a recognition, a revelation of your love for that person. Speak to them heart to heart, face to face, and assure them of your love and your promise that as they go, you are with them. You will be with them. Father, I pray that you would reveal these promises into our hearts and so that we would receive them. And Father, my heart yearns for those who get tied up, because it's for all of us, Lord. I know what it's like when we get tied up in guilt and shame. And Father, I want to pray, Lord, that picture that you give us in Zechariah 3. Lord, I pray that you would just speak to each and every person who felt unable to advance the way you're calling them to advance because of guilt and shame. Father, I pray that they would really see you taking off these filthy robes and putting on your fresh, clean robe of grace, of love, of mercy, of truth. Pour out your spirit, Lord. Refresh us. Stir us up, Lord. Stir us up to be the people that you are calling us to be. Set us free, Lord. Set us free, Lord, to run. Father, we can see the need. Equip us, Lord. Enable us. Cut off those things that are binding us. Pour your power out upon us. Pour your love, Lord, so that we can walk out the lives that you're calling us to walk out. Father, speak to us where you're saying clearly there are things that you want us to go to. Speak to us, Lord. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. Perhaps the prayer teams would like to come up and pray with people. There are quite a lot of people here, so if you're in a home group, a home group leader, please come and pray with people. Thank you. Let's worship. And let's keep this area quiet, please. If you are going to tea and coffee, please feel free to do that. But please keep this area quiet so that we can pray with people.
You've shown